Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staper, a show about science, technology, and the future of our environment. When most people imagine a satellite hurtling through space, we imagine a metal cylinder with panels popping off in all directions. We don't imagine them being made from wood. Wood is simply not synonymous with space travel, but maybe it should be. Researchers at Kyoto University in Japan have launched the world's first wood-paneled satellite. Dr. Simeon Barber is a planetary scientist at the Open University in the United Kingdom, and he joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to All Sides, Dr. Barber.
Thank you, and good morning.
Wood isn't a material that comes to mind when we think of objects in space. What makes it a good candidate for interstellar travel?
You're right, Tanya. It sounds low tech and a bit old fashioned. But actually, you know, wood is a really remarkable material. It is strong. It is about as strong as aluminium for its mass. And what the researchers here are really interested in and pushing is that when the satellite comes to the end of its life, having performed just like an aluminium satellite would have done, satellites are burned up in the Earth's atmosphere as they come down to the surface. And as that burn-up process happens with aluminium satellites, you get lots of tiny metallic particles released into the atmosphere, and those can contribute to global warming and climate change, whereas the burn-up of a wooden satellite, in theory, would create fewer of those particles and would disintegrate into gases. So it could be a cleaner way of building satellites.
Yeah, it's called LingoSat, which I understand is after the Latin word for wood. Can you tell us a little bit about this specific satellite? What type of wood did they use?
Sure. So they tested a number of woods, but in the end, settled for something which is basically a magnolia tree, because it has small cells and it's quite uniform. So its strength is kind of easy to predict, and it doesn't have as much of a grain as other woods might do. And the satellite itself, just to put this in context, you know, I could hold it in the palm of my hand. It's a cube, which is 4 inches along each side, and it weighs just a few pounds. So it's a tiny little thing, and it's just like a first baby step into this idea of trying to make satellites out of wood. But you've got to make a first step on any journey, of course.
Yeah. Are different types of wood better than others? Like, did they rule out some as just not being a good idea?
Yeah, so they went through a test program and I think down selected to three before finally choosing magnolia. You know, they're all very different to aluminium, sorry.
That's okay. I am enjoying the accent. Secretly trying to figure out how to get you to say oregano.
I'll try my best. So they've down selected to this wood, which is you know, apparently it's the best they could find for certain selection criteria. But to be honest, this is so far removed from aluminium that, you know, it's just a step into the unknown, to be honest. And that's why this experiment's been done.
Yeah. So as you said, wooden satellites are likely to burn up on reentry, which could be good for the environment. But if it burns up, how are scientists and researchers going to monitor how well the wood performs in space?
Sure. So this satellite was launched last week on a SpaceX rocket and a Dragon spacecraft. It was taken to the International Space Station. So in a couple of weeks' time, it's going to be released from the International Space Station into its own free-flying orbit. So it's going to be orbiting the Earth at about 250 miles of altitude. And it's going to be going around the Earth, and through that cycle, it's going to go through really extreme temperature changes as it goes from day to night. So it's going to be, in the day, it's going to be at 300 Fahrenheit. And then quickly, as it passes into the night side, it's going to be at minus 200 Fahrenheit. So it's going through this massive temperature shift. So all the time, the wood will be contracting and swelling and twisting. And it will also be absorbing radiation that is coming from space. And the sensors inside the spacecraft, which are normal electronic components, will be measuring how much protection they're getting in effect from the wood that's around them. measuring how that temperature is changing and how the wood is insulating the spacecraft from those temperature extremes. And all that data then will be downlinked to Earth, beamed to Earth in radio telecoms. And so that data will be available for hopefully a 6-month period as the satellite ages, basically. So we get data on the ground throughout the mission.
I imagine now that you've said that, given the temperature extremes, that the wood has to be very dried out before it's used, because wood can hold moisture. And when you're building, you got to dry the wood out before you build with it. I assume moisture in this was very closely monitored.
Right, absolutely. So, yeah, anyone who's tried to build a, you know, a timber framed house or a, you know, shed or whatever structure, you know that you're reliant upon the quality of the timber you're getting from your yard, and you want to make sure that it's been treated and aged and conditioned. And I think that's possibly one of the challenges that is faced here, because satellites are usually launched from fairly humid places, you know, Florida, for instance. But when you get into space, just a few minutes later, the environment is incredibly dry. And so the moisture in the wood is going to come out, and that's what could cause the structure of the wood to change in its shape. And that's, I think, one of the key challenges that is faced if we're going to try and make a future of launching wooden satellites from Earth.
One of the most fascinating parts of this to me is using wood could go with the idea of travel beyond our planet. That if one day we could grow trees on Mars or in space, that we would have a renewable source material once we get there.
Right. I think this is where it gets really exciting.
Very sci-fi.
So we started the show by saying, you know, wood is low tech because we're familiar with it, right? You know, if we were to call it a self-generating, self-assembling, three-dimensional biopolymer with you know, great structural and thermal properties, then it sounds a bit more high tech, and that's actually what wood is. So, you know, the real excitement comes is if we could, rather than take wood from Earth, that there's no point doing that. There's no point taking wood from Earth to go and build in space with it. But what if you could grow wood on another planet and then use it? We know that, you know, the first settlers anywhere generally make use of local resources to try and create shelter to protect themselves so they can then, you know, start building camp and you know, start flourishing, hopefully. And of all the places that this might be feasible, and we're talking long-term vision here, but why not? Is Mars. So wood grows, as we probably know, by photosynthesis. So you need sunlight, you need water, and you need carbon dioxide in an atmosphere. And although the atmosphere on Mars is very, very thin, it's 1% of the atmosphere on Earth, it's purely made of carbon dioxide. So tick against carbon dioxide. Recent observations from Mars are giving more and more evidence that there's quite a lot of water on Mars beneath the surface. And of course, Mars has sunlight. So in theory, a lot of the conditions are present there to start thinking about growing plants, trees on Mars. If you can do so, you can launch much lighter spacecraft from Earth, which is greener again, but it's also more sustainable economically, because the bigger the rocket, the more stuff you need to take, the more it costs. So we can have smaller rockets going to Mars, setting up these plants to start growing some of the materials that can be used to start creating habitats that humans could live in. There's a lot of problems to be solved before we do that, but that's why this journey is really exciting.
Yeah, and one of the fascinating things to me, which I didn't even consider, is that there's not water really in space. So wood rot, like growth of microbiomes, like a lot of the things that get wood over time here on Earth just don't exist out in the universe.
Yeah, so naturally it might be a more resilient species, for sure. And it's also been said that wood wouldn't burn because, you know, there's no atmosphere for it to combust in. Although, of course, if we're talking about human structures, we're going to have plenty of oxygen around, so we
That's
have to be
fair.
careful about that. But you have to kind of, yeah, reconsider how wood would behave in the alien environment that you're going to take it to.
And if we were going to take it to Mars, we'd have to figure out how to get them to grow in colder conditions with less sunlight.
Absolutely. So, yeah, Mars is generally colder than on Earth. And you know, there is genuine scientific research being conducted into how to do that. You know, do you have to go as far as to change, you know, terraforming, making Earth-like planets? You know, this is sci-fi and Hollywood movie stuff. You know, do you have to go that far, or can you create local kind of biodomes that have kind of a local atmosphere that is warmer, like greenhouses, I guess, on Earth? So all of these things are technically feasible, I'd say. One of the big challenges actually is at the moment, we've no idea if there's life on Mars already, which we honestly don't know. And before that question is answered, there are really strong reasons, legally and ethically, why, you know, we shouldn't be sending life forms from Earth to Mars until we know what we find there. So, you know, that's why it's interesting. There are technical challenges, there are ethical, legal challenges, and, you know, the rocket science is the easy bit sometimes.
When you say life on Mars, though, you don't mean little green men hiding under the surface. You mean more like organisms and like bacteria that live there, right?
Most likely, yeah, you know, potentially primitive organisms that,
Not
you
hearing a no to the little green men.
know, I didn't say no to little green men, but you know, I you know, it would be the most amazing scientific discovery, I think, if future missions to Mars and ones that are orbiting Mars now do find evidence that there is life on Mars. We honestly don't know. We don't have evidence that there is. But lack of evidence is not evidence of lack. And so until we've ruled it out, we have to kind of, you know, we have to act with caution.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of, colonization of the Americas. We brought a lot of diseases that the native people just didn't know how to weather. And that sounds like that might be the concern if you introduce a bunch of Earth species to a planet that has no idea what it is.
Sure. And you know, I completely accept there'll be a lot of people listening here who may think it's a terrible idea to go and explore space and, you know, try and build habitats on Mars. I get that. And, you know, I guess what we've got to do is ensure that we don't make mistakes that have been made before. So it's kind of okay to make new mistakes, but not repeat mistakes of the past, because that's how we move forward, hopefully.
I want to go back to the satellite for a moment. So, one of the perks, I guess, of having wood is a reduction in space junk. How big of a problem is pollution in outer space?
So space is a big place, yes, but our little part of it around Earth is getting pretty busy. So there are t about 10,000 satellites orbiting Earth right now. And they're going up at the rate of thousands per year. So that is a curve which is going through the roof very quickly. So this is something that many in the space community are getting very concerned about, because there are regions of space where you want to put satellites so that they're, you know, it's like the prime real estate in space that has the best coverage of telecommunication to Earth or whatever other conditions you want for your satellite. So those places are getting quite crowded. You can make sure that satellites don't collide with each other, because you can put them into their own orbits. But the problem is that when you have a when satellites come back down to Earth, and if they disintegrate and leave particles in the kind of space where you're trying to fly still working satellites, even tiny, tiny particles, because they're traveling at really huge speeds, can create massive problems, you know, blow holes in satellites, knock them out entirely. So really, it's the tiny stuff that we can't see which is the real danger, because you know, if you can't see it, you can't dodge it.
It kind of sounds like the rings around Saturn, that we're sort of building our own space junk rings around planet Earth.
It's quite a good analogy. And you know, we've learnt about those rings around Saturn, and they're, you know, they're not going to be there forever. They're changing right now. So we've got missions that have looked at Saturn and flown through the rings in recent years, you know, Cassini-Huygens, and you know, those rings are changing all the time. Particles are colliding, the rings are getting destroyed. You know, space is not a static place that doesn't change. And the problem is that we're really accelerating the change of space around Earth by flying, you know, thousands and thousands of tons of satellites into Earth orbit. And we don't really know, you know, the consequences of that until further down the line, which is why I think it's really, you know, interesting, this kind of experiment where you give it a go and you learn from it. And we'll, you know, hopefully we'll come back in a few months' time and we'll look at what the results are, and we'll draw conclusions. And maybe the next satellite is a is a meter cubed rather than 4 inches cubed.
That was Dr. Simeon Barber, a planetary scientist at the Open University in the United Kingdom. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We'll have to circle back once we know how well wood does in space. I'm so excited about this.
Yeah, it'd be cool to know, cool to follow up and see how they get on.
Coming up, how DNA is rewriting the stories we tell about Pompeii. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7. NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Over time, archaeologists combing through the ruins of Pompeii came to certain conclusions about those entombed within the ash, guessing at likely relationships, genders, and family ties. Now, using DNA, researchers have learned that their long-held assumptions may have missed the mark. Miami University professor of history and classics, Stephen Truck, joins us now to talk about the new news from Pompeii. Welcome to All Sides, Professor.
Thank you very much.
There's long been a fascination with life in Pompeii and how one volcanic eruption froze this civilization in time. It's been described as an eerie time capsule, and we're learning new things about it. So the DNA analysis came from plaster casts of some of the Pompeii victims. How is this done? How is this extracted?
So this is actually, I think, absolutely fascinating research. These casts are casts that are put around the skeletons of deceased individuals. So the skeletal material is still inside that cast. The cast takes the place of the soft tissues that dissolved over time in the eruption. And so by boring into the bones, in particular, the long bones and pelvis, you can extract DNA material from the bones, and then particularly run a number of really interesting analyses. You can sex the individuals, and most importantly, say what their genetic makeup was, where they're from, or where their ancestry is from, and those are exciting discoveries.
How has the DNA survived for so long? That's like my first question.
Well, we're very fortunate at Pompeii because the eruption there was actually very cool. These people died largely covered by ash and pumice. And so unlike the sister city of Herculaneum, which was hit by these pyroclastic flows of essentially superheated liquid rock that then burned everybody alive and solidified. At Pompeii, they were encased in ash and pumice, which does not destroy the DNA that survives in, for example, in teeth. And so you can drill into the roots of teeth and get the DNA. It's not altered by the eruption.
That's wild. Also, it's strange to think of volcano eruptions as being cooler than others. I guess there's different classes of different kinds of eruptions.
There's a lot. This was a very complex event. Pompeii was hit, and then there's Herculaneum 7 miles away. Completely different eruptive event. It's wild, as you said. Yeah.
So over the years, we've looked at the victims that were encased in Pompeii, and we've made certain assumptions about who they were, about how they were related. And this DNA is showing that we may have been wrong, particularly about one older adult curved around a child.
Yeah, not just that we may have been wrong. Boy, were we wrong. I think Yeah, I think there's no doubt this research is excellent. It's cutting edge and it's absolutely correct. And yeah, so the excavators and people who came after them looked at these people huddled together and assumed that those people that were comforting others must have been women, must have been mothers, and therefore they created these wonderful, poignant narratives of families and loss and mothers and children, or entire, immediate families together. And as I say, boy, we got that wrong. The research makes it just so clear that none of these people were genetically related. None of them.
Yeah, the mother and child is a guy, an adult male, and a young child who is not biologically related to him.
Right, absolutely. And I think that's important on two levels. Number one, the assumption that that only women can be nurturing is a little troubling, and I would like to see that we could get rid of that. But also, this assumption of relationships really projects back to the Roman world our own notion of family, that family is people that you're related to by blood. Primarily immediate family. And that's not the ancient Roman idea of family. The ancient Roman notion of family is much broader. Includes everybody in the household. And so these could actually be families, not to substitute one unprovable narrative for another, but yeah, they could absolutely be families in the Roman sense.
In some ways, though, I think the idea in the moment, it must have been chaotic and terrifying and all kinds of like every bad adjective you can think of. But in some ways, it seems almost sweeter to me that maybe an adult male grabbed this young child who was lost and they were together rather than being alone at the end.
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. What we're seeing here are people coming together in this awful, just chaotic natural disaster and seeking shelter, comforting each other in a way that's it's essentially it's the best of humanity here. People who may not be related or have any responsibility for each other, but trying to help out. Trying to comfort people, trying to shelter people that they are not at all related to. You're absolutely right. I think that is that's certainly a strong possibility, and it is it's touching, I think.
You've also done research about possible survivors of the eruption, people who got away in time. I find that also particularly fascinating because it sounds like part of the reason it was so well preserved is because this tragedy unfolded so very quickly.
Well, it did unfold quickly, but it unfolded over pretty much an 18-hour period. So these people who did not leave may not have had the opportunity to leave, or may have, been ordered to stay by property owners. A lot of the genetics here of these people indicate that they're not from Italy. That their ancestors from the Eastern Mediterranean. And I think it's entirely possible that what we have here are enslaved or formerly enslaved people. And it's certainly possible that they couldn't get out or weren't allowed to get out. But there are people that did make it out. And I think that's fascinating to look at these and also think about those other people and what these tell us about the makeup of between the two groups, what they tell us about the whole makeup of the population.
Yeah, that feels incredibly sad to think that the people who died were the people forced to stay.
I wonder about that. The makeup of the bodies as we thought they were are spread across men, women, old, young. But as more of this analysis is done, particularly about ancestry and sex, I really wonder if we're going to see that those assumptions shift.
Joining us now is Katie Barrett, an associate professor of classics at Cornell University. She's also the co-director of an excavation at Pompeii. Thanks for joining us, Professor.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So I hope I'm going to say this correct, you're doing the Casa della Regina Carolina project?
That's right,
Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So it's a project that's jointly sponsored by University of Bologna in Italy and Cornell and Harvard in the US. And we're documenting a large house and excavating its garden. And we're trying to find out a few different things. One is what the garden can tell us about life in 79 CE at the time of Vesuvius's eruption. And we also want to look beneath the garden levels to learn more about the history of pre-Roman Pompeii. We think of Pompeii as this archetypally Roman city, but really it wasn't formally Roman citizens living there until the first century BCE.
I understand you're using 3D modeling. How is that helping you reconstruct life in Pompeii?
That's right. We've recently gotten funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities to pursue a 3D model of the house and garden, working with colleagues at CNRS and UCO Laval in France. So basically, a lot of previous studies of Pompeian houses have centered the experiences of the often wealthy people who owned the house. And we know quite a lot about the elite house owner experience. We want to know more about everybody else who would have lived in these houses. In this case, it's a large building. There was probably a large staff of enslaved people who were forced to work there. There probably would have also been people of different, say, age or ability categories, like children or elderly relatives. So we want to understand how this space would have provided affordances for different people. And variables of age or gender or disability would have really shaped how people could physically experience Roman houses. Like slippery floors, steep staircases, or open pools would have created very different kinds of risks or opportunities for, say, small children or disabled or elderly persons. So we want to use digital modeling to try to recreate the environment and explore what its affordances would have been for everybody who lived there. There's also a communication element in that we want the digital model to be available to the public, and then this can hopefully be a way of communicating how we think this site would have functioned, what it would have looked like, what the life of the people would have been like, in a broader way than an academic article might be able to reach. We also want to use the site and the model as a research tool to crowdsource people's patterns of circulation or responses to the space.
Stephen, I wonder what it is about Pompeii that continues to fascinate us nearly 2,000 years after its destruction.
Well, I think there's an inescapable empathy that we all feel when we're faced with people who had lives as full and rich as ours, and about whom we can find out so much. We can see the places where they lived. We can even sadly see their remains. And I think it's very moving that the full spectrum of Roman society is so clearly on display in Pompeii, from like palatial dwellings with beautifully frescoed and mosaic rooms to the simpler living spaces of shopkeepers who lived above their stores to like the cramped quarters of the brothel or the bakery recently excavated where enslaved people seem to have been imprisoned. And all the glimpses of everyday life, like graffiti that might have been left by children in some cases. The humanity is just so clearly apparent.
Now, Stephen, why do you think it continues to just like we can't everybody it's one of those names. If you listed off 100 ancient Roman cities, it's one of the ones I think most people just know, and they're like, oh, that's the place with the volcano.
It's definitely in the top three, I think. Yeah. No, I think Dr. Barrett's absolutely correct. You know, as archaeologists, we focus on material culture. We excavate, we find things, but really it all comes back to the people. And Pompeii is a place where we can get back much more easily to the people, and we can find out what their lives were like. And through, for example, the graffiti that you mentioned, you know, we know what they loved, where they hung around. Sometimes because of different languages or names, we know where they came from to come to Pompeii. And it really gives us just such a rich view of every facet of society. You know, I have a degree in classics and I love reading, you know, the ancient sources, But they're almost all elite men talking to other elite men. It's only in archaeology and through places like Pompeii that we see and can experience and engage with the other 90% of society. And I think that's just so vital.
Professor Barrett, how do you think this DNA discovery is going to change the way we think about Pompeii?
I think it's really interesting to see how diverse the population may have been. This isn't in and of itself surprising on other grounds. I mean, Pompeii was located next to one of the busiest ports in the ancient world, and the Roman Empire extended from Britain to North Africa in this period. So there was a lot of mobility, often people forced to move from one location to another through enslavement and war. Also, other forms of mobility like trade. There seems to have been an Egyptian community or an Alexandrian community anyway, living in Naples, not far away. And it's a place that has a long history of Greek settlement going back almost a millennium before the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. So it makes sense that the background and the appearance of the population would have reflected how interconnected the ancient world was. And I think sometimes it can be tempting to imagine ancient civilizations as though they existed in different little boxes. Like you have the Egyptians here, and the Greeks here, and the Romans here. But really, the ancient Mediterranean, North African, and Near Eastern world was an incredibly interconnected network, is sometimes in ways that were creative and generative, sometimes in ways that speak to the darkest aspects of ancient history. It's all there. And I also think it's useful to be reminded that some of the assumptions that we're tempted to make about the dead on the basis of the caste and the basis of modern ideas about social roles of various kinds, that those are dangerous. It's dangerous to make those assumptions. Assuming that a person holding a child must be a woman is an assumption that's going to get you in trouble. And anybody of any gender identity is capable of caring for somebody and protecting them. And we don't know what relationship existed between these two individuals, but whoever that person was who was trying to protect the child, they gave that child their last moments of comfort.
Yeah. Stephen, I think one of the things that also we made assumptions about was the jewelry that we found on people and assigning gender based on bracelets and necklaces and saying, ah, this is a woman.
Yeah, then and that's completely understandable. But again, as you mentioned, in the chaos of an eruption, I think people are grabbing things. There were many houses had strong boxes where their valuables were kept at Pompeii. And with one exception, all of these were, when discovered, were empty. And so people, in the early phases of the eruption, they grabbed their money, their jewelry, their valuables, and prepared to leave. And so I could easily see, as you're scooping up the family jewelry, but you have other things in your hands, the natural place to put a bracelet, man or woman, is on your arm, and it frees your hands. And so I thought that was particularly interesting to see, because I think that's just a little sort of an insight into what's going on in those last hours, as people are grabbing things and fleeing. And many of these casts were found with small amounts of money and jewelry on them. Pretty much all of them, actually, if they're found in groups, have small amounts of this. And I think it speaks to that chaotic experience, not to the gender of the individual. And that was a great reminder.
Professor Barrett, how do we see the 3D model? How do we find your work if I really want to take a walk through a house in Pompeii, at least virtually?
Well, it's still under construction, so ask me again in another 6 months.
Okay.
But for the time being, our project has a website, and we're always interested in hearing from people who are interested in learning more. Once we do publish the model, we're going to make it as widely available as we can to see how different people respond.
What's the website?
Well, it's if you Google CRC Pompeii Cornell,
There, that's probably the easiest way.
Yeah.
Great. That was Professor Katie Barrett of Cornell University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you to Miami University Professor of History and Classics, Stephen Tuck.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, we're talking about something that we all may need a little bit of right now, a digital detox. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Do you feel naked without your phone? Like, no matter how hard you try to put it down and forget about it, you still end up somehow with the device back in your hand? If that sounds like you, then maybe it's time for a digital detox. Emily Turkin is a screen time consultant who helps people balance their online life with their IRL. Welcome to All Sides, Emily.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
To start off, why is it so hard for us to not fiddle with our phones?
Great question. Because they're designed to hook and hold our attention. They tap into our dopamine. They make us feel important and good, and we get feedback immediately. So it's very satisfying to have them in our hands.
Yeah, we did a show a while back on going for like dumb phone February, I think it was, where you like, and one of the things that people struggle with is that need to like tap something. Like they even buy fidgets because their hands are conditioned to tap.
Totally, totally. And we're talking about adults, right? I do a lot of work with parents and schools, and you know, it's children that are having a much harder time. So we, you know, if it's hard for us to put them down, we can't be surprised that kids struggle too.
So do you think that when we estimate how much time we spend on our phones in a day, is it kind of like our calories where we're kind of underguessing by a decent chunk?
We definitely underestimate. We underreport. It's always humbling when you get those like reports on the weekend when it's like how many hours, and you're like, "There's no way I did that." But the reality is, yeah. And I, you know, I often say that our phones are not switchblades; they're Swiss Army knives because we use them for so many different things. It's not like old school landlines where you just picked it up and made a phone call. You know, where it's a calculator, it's a banking tool, it's shopping, it's phones, it's a camera. You know, so there's all kinds of multi-tool pieces. So it's not that it's all being used for the same purpose, but I do think the majority of our time is probably spent in, you know, doom scrolling.
So let's talk about digital detoxes. How on earth do we do this, particularly if we have the kind of job where we are maybe need to be in contact?
Yeah, I was just talking to your producer about like, remember the days when you didn't check email in the evening and on the weekends? Like, like we actually would go full days without responding to things. You know, I think for us, and actually I'm glad we're talking about adults because in a lot of ways we can't help our kids until we address it ourselves. And so one of my favorite strategies is to recommend people, and especially adults, live their life out loud, which means narrating what you do as you do it with your phone, which goes back to like pointing out that it's this multi-tool. So that can bring attention to it. We can talk about how it makes us feel when we like, oh, I'm bored. I'm reaching for Instagram. I'm just standing here in line at the coffee shop and I'm scrolling. I don't feel better. Now I'm bored again. Like, I think articulating it helps. It's a little bit less like calorie counting and more like writing down what you eat.
Ah, like a food journal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's one of those instincts that I particularly have. Like, I'm waiting in line at the grocery store or somewhere, and it's just instinctive. You flick your phone open, and even if you're reading an article, which is arguably maybe healthier than, like, playing Candy Crush, but, like, it's still just more screen time and that desire to, I guess, fill every single moment with stimulation.
Yeah. And it's funny because there's this real paradox here that, like, our phones, in theory, make our lives more smooth, convenient, easy, you know, but the reality is that our learning happens in moments of friction. And we tend to want to self-soothe, avoid uncomfortable things, disengage from, you know, fears and anxieties, which is sometimes a good thing. But we do that by reaching for our phone that doesn't actually then encourage us to like push through that discomfort. So, you know, sometimes it can be just a single moment of intentionality. I talk a lot about being tech intentional. And so, you know, if you are in the coffee shop line and it's like, I feel that instinct. Say, you know, saying it out loud, I'm feeling like I want to pull my phone out, but instead I'm going to talk to the person in line next to me. Of course, you're going to shock them, right? No one does this anymore. But, you know, I think there's some social norms that need to be shifted, and it's going to start with each one of us maybe not pulling our phone out at every moment.
So how exactly does a digital detox work? Do I put my phone in a drawer and just leave it there for as long as I can?
You know, it's going to look different for everybody. I mean, I think the word detox gets kind of wrapped up in all sorts of heavy connotations as well. I mean, I really believe that baby steps is the way to make long-term lasting change. So especially for parents, but all adults, I mean, the first question I ask is, where does your phone sleep at night? If it's 95% of the time, and I do survey parent communities I speak to, it's like in my bedroom. So, you know, to me, that's a low-hanging fruit. It's a very easy starting point. If people are like, but it's my alarm clock, I always joke that, you know, your alarm clock doesn't attach to social media or the internet, and, you know, they're cheap and you can get them pretty easily. They're very reliable. Just putting your phone even outside your bedroom, or even baby step it across the, you know, other side of the room, you know, it's when we can turn over and roll and scroll in the morning, you know, that's not a great way to start our day. And it models something for our kids. It's saying, that's the most important thing. That's the first thing I do in the morning. And it's gonna be real hard to tell those teenagers not to put their phones in their room.
Yeah, that's probably a good point, especially as they get older. If you don't want them logging on at night, staying up late at night, it's hard when yours is in your room just because it's your alarm clock.
Exactly.
Which mine is my alarm clock, I will confess. Like, it's right there next to, I have one of those stations. It's got like my watch and my phone, and it's right there on the nightstand.
Yeah, so maybe it's just putting it on the other side of the room and starting there, or just outside the hall. You know, it's going to start. That's an easy one, I think. You know, there's other things you can do, like turn your phone to grayscale, which is really makes it very unappealing to have to like scroll. I didn't have social media apps on my phone for a long time. And then, of course, as you point out with work, right, like, it, you know, there are these tools that we use. And, you know, again, I just keep thinking about the fact that I'm an adult. At least I can theoretically make intentional choices. So, but it's a struggle. I notice it for myself too. And I've been doing this work for years.
We have a no phones at the dinner table rule, which I think is another one of those very small steps. Like, we're just not going to have our phones while we eat.
Yep. That's a great one. And again, tech intentional is like just picking and being specific about it and modeling it. You know, another one I hear, you know, family movie nights, people are always like, well, I love watching movies with my family. Great. It's one movie, one family though. It's not parents on their phones scrolling on the couch while the movie plays, right? Like just little things like that, you know, or choices within choices. Like I talk a lot about like, you know, a bigger screen is better than a smaller screen. No headphones is better than headphones. A public space is better than a private space. So like, just especially for children, right? Like when they're consuming it. So it's, those are sort of things, if they're going to be using screens, that we can be more intentional within those choices.
How do we know when it's too much? I guess if we're wondering about it, it may be already too much.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is probably adults are all using it too much. You just walk around on the street now. And like, I think about it, you know, that when it's so mind-boggling to me, if we were to carry around all of the tools that exist in our phone, you know, like if we had a camera and a computer and a calendar and an encyclopedia and like, you know, I don't know, a shopping mall, all of the things, you know, we couldn't physically carry that. Like when you think of that visual, it's pretty shocking to think about how we just have it in our pockets. So, you know, I think I always say a little bit's okay and a lot's too much. And it really depends on the person, which isn't very helpful. Sorry.
Yeah. I know you offer family coaching and one-on-one coaching sessions, but how do you begin to have this conversation with your partner, with your children?
Yeah. It's a great question. And it's usually the first thing I hear when I'm doing talks, you know, there's someone in the front row elbowing their partner, like, this is your problem. I mean, it starts at finding common ground. What's the goal here? You know, what do you want for your kids? What do you want for your family? I talk a lot about identifying the values that are important to your you and your family, and how does technology affect those or fold into those? Again, it's not that it can't exist. It's kind of hard to exist in the world without it. But I think less is, my TLDR is less is more, later is better, relationships and skills first.
That seems like a good jumping off point. Are there different tactics that are more effective depending on age?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of talk about parental controls. I think there's a lot of things you can do to block and filter and monitor. I have some really strong feelings about that because every single parent I've talked to is like, my kid found the workaround. So it can be one tool in your toolbox, but you cannot rely on it as the sole solution because it won't work. And part of that is, you know, even people who design these products and tools to help families and kids, they can't get, you know, like you can't monitor in-app content via a third party, right? Like, so there's that kind of challenge as well. And that's makes it even harder as a parent. So I think the better question to ask is, do you know what your kid's really doing online? Not because you monitor, but because you have conversations, you watch, you talk about it, and you have a good relationship with your child, which is obviously going to be related to the first question. You know, to be able to talk about it, you have to have a good relationship.
What are some tactics that are, do you think are most helpful for adults? Like, I mean, getting a fidget is one thing that you can do if you feel that need to touch something over and over, because we're conditioned to pick up our phones like 80 times a day. It's something terrifying.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually have fidgets on my desk, you know, or a stand, you know, when I'm working, and sometimes I have a standing desk and I, you know, I'm bouncing around on my feet. I'm more of a fidgety person, but, you know, like I said, getting the phone out of the room, just being intentional. There are some, you know, like there's something called the light phone, and I don't endorse any products, but like there are some minimalist tools that we can use. And I think it's a good exercise for us to try to experiment a little bit with like, how long can we go? Can we walk the dog and leave our phone at home, right? Just around the block. What would happen? What's the worst thing that could happen, right?
There's that fear though. There's that fear of like, I forgot my phone the other day when I went to the grocery store, and I'm like, what if my husband needs to reach me? What if there's an emergency with the kids?
Yeah. And this is so hard because we have to remember that we've existed for centuries where we didn't get immediate news. And in fact, I would argue that 24/7 consumption of media is actually increasing our anxiety, not decreasing it.
Yeah, it is hard though. You feel that momentary panic of like, oh no, I've forgotten my phone.
I know. Yeah, it's true. And it's really a good exercise for us to push through that.
That's probably a good point. Oh, well, I even use it for running. Like, it's got the music when I go running. So like, I take it with me literally everywhere.
I miss the iPod, right? Like, you know, or the shuffle, like where you could just have the music. You didn't have to bring your huge phone. You could detach a little, you know, maybe I like to bring back old tech is kind of my favorite hashtag. CD-ROM, you know, back to those days.
Oh, we did a show a while back where apparently Walkmans are making a comeback, which I find very funny.
I heard that. And flip phones, you know, old school flip phones. And I, you know, there's always going to be sort of these countercultural movements. And actually, I think for kids, that's the best way to go. That's, you know, an old school flip phone that's not internet connected, at serve as a communication tool. Because if that's really what you want is a way to communicate, then they don't need internet access. They just need a phone.
Yeah, because one of the things that's really changed, like when my kids go to play dates or sleepovers or whatever they're doing, there's no house phone for them to call me on anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, that changes the conversation a little bit about like, hey, you know, our kid doesn't have a phone, but I want to be able to like check in with her in the morning. Can I, you know, can you use her phone? She use your phone. And yeah, it's awkward, but that's also the norm now. Like nobody does have that landline. So yeah, it's tricky. I share my phone with my 13-year-old, which has been very interesting.
You share it.
We share a smartphone. Now,
that
I say
is wild sounding.
It is. And the best part is that her school has a no phone policy. So it makes my job really easy. Like she can't take it to school anyway. So shout out to all the schools making that change because that makes parents' lives easier. But it's an iPhone. And so it does connect to an iPad. So when she's home, if she wants to text with her friends, she uses the iPad, which feels a little bit like her own. But I mean, again, I'm not like sitting here just watching all of her texts come through because I have other things to do, but it fosters a really great conversation and we problem solve in real time. And I taught middle school for 12 years, so I'm very familiar with this age group. So I feel like I can handle that, but it's not for everybody. But it's a strategy that has helped us delay it.
That was Screen Time consultant Emily Turkin. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides right here on 89.7 NPR News.